From Quality Radio Productions, it's the Upstate Radio Theater, an hour of sounds from radio's golden age. I'm Jake Longwell, getting the hour underway with an episode of Tales of Tomorrow, one of the great science fiction radio series of the 1950s. The series made a very successful transition to television and was a huge hit on the small screen also during that decade. This is program number 4 in the series, originally broadcast January 22nd, 1953 on ABC, starring, among others, Dick York, who was the original Darren Stevens on the hit TV series Bewitched. The title of this episode of Tales of Tomorrow, The Other Now.
Tales of Tomorrow. Tales beyond human imagination. Until they happen. Tales of Tomorrow. Story number 4. The Other Now by Murray Leinster.
This is your host, Omentor, saying hello for ABC. Look at your watch, but don't take it too seriously. If it's a few seconds after 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, in California, it's 3 hours earlier. In London, it's 2 o'clock tomorrow morning. And in Japan, it's almost tomorrow afternoon. What time is it right now on the planet Saturn? A silly question? I wonder. The point is, time is a clock with many faces. Your time is not necessarily anyone else's. And what we think of as the present is only relative. Let's prove that thesis with a remarkable tale from Galaxy, the science fiction magazine. A most timely story titled, The Other Now.
My name is Hal Haines. I was Jimmy Patterson's best friend, which is why he dared tell me the story you are about to hear. I'm speaking into a recording machine, the tape to be played back only after my death, for reasons that'll become obvious as you listen. First, you've got to understand that Jimmy and Jane Patterson loved each other like no two other people I ever met. That's important to the story. It all began about a year after their marriage. They'd been to a party at my apartment and started home about 2 a.m.
Darling.
Hmm?
Nothing.
Well, what's so funny?
You. The way you always stick out your jaw when you're behind the wheel. It's kind of cute.
Now, I resent that. A man is attractive, handsome, virile, compelling, but never cute.
Darling, you're all those things, and cute. Jimmy, that truck in front of us, what's that long pole sticking out behind it?
It looks like a steel girder. Yeah, that's what it is. Oh. See the red flag?
Pass that truck, please.
What's the matter, huh?
I don't like driving behind that thing. It makes me nervous.
All right, here we go. Jane, brace yourself.
What?
The truck's stopping short. Air brakes.
Jimmy, we did it!
I know, I can't stop.
Jimmy phoned me from the hospital. When I got there, the doctors told me about Jane. Death had been mercifully swift. Jimmy was sitting on a bench in one of the corridors, his face buried in his hands.
Jimmy. Jim, it's me.
Did they tell you?
Yeah. What can I say?
Oh, hell, she's gone. She's gone.
I know.
It happened so fast, a freak accident doesn't make sense.
I know. Listen, anything I can do...
One minute she was beside me alive, and the next minute... Hal, why did it have to happen this way? Why couldn't it have been me?
The next 3 months were bad. At first, I feared Jimmy might do something desperate. But soon, the torture of being alive while Jane was dead slacked up until, from an intolerable agony, became a dull, ever-present ache. The worst moment was coming home from work to the empty apartment. So Jimmy arranged always to have the cleaning woman there. It was better than nothing. On the night the thing really began, Jimmy came home from work with the usual hopeless ache in his heart. Putting the key in the lock, he thought, if only Jane were there to meet him. If only by some miracle. But there were no miracles, he knew that. He unlocked the front door, opened it, began to walk in, and crashed against the door. It was closed. He just opened it, but it was closed. Jimmy's first impression was that his brain was playing tricks on him. Had he really opened that door? It seemed to him that he had, but in his confused state of mind, he couldn't be absolutely sure. He unlocked the door again. Or was it again? Opened it and walked into the apartment. The cleaning woman, Mrs. Mooney, was in the living room.
Hello, Mrs. Mooney.
Oh, Mr. Patterson. How do you feel today, sir?
Fine, thanks.
You didn't sleep again last night, sir.
Of course I did.
When I came in this afternoon, the bed was still made up, just as I'd left it yesterday.
I fell asleep in the armchair. Please stop checking on me, Mrs. Mooney.
I don't want you to think of it that way, Mr. Patterson. But you haven't been yourself since the Mrs. Well, what I mean is, I'm worried about you.
There's nothing to worry about. Anyone phone while you've been here?
Mr. Haynes called.
What did he want?
Said he hadn't heard from you for a couple of days. Want you to call him back, sir.
Thanks, I'll do that. Anything else?
Yes. I found this carton of cigarettes in the Mrs. desk.
Those are Jane's?
Yes, sir.
Must have overlooked them when I cleaned out the desk.
What should I...
Throw them out. No, just a second. Put them back in the desk.
All right, sir.
Before you do that, Mrs. Mooney's there's something I want to ask you. Did you hear me come in just now?
Yes, sir.
Well, did you notice if I opened the front door once or twice?
Why would you open the door twice, sir?
I don't know if I did. That's what I'm trying to find out. Did you hear the door open twice?
I really couldn't say, Mr. Patterson.
Oh, think back. Try to remember.
Well, you did open it twice, sir.
Are you sure?
I think so, but maybe I just imagined it. You don't look so good, Mr. Patterson. You ought to take a nap before dinner.
I'm all right.
No, you aren't. I think...
Please, Mrs. Mooney, stop fussing over me. Just leave me alone.
Jimmy took sleeping pills that night. When he finally drifted off, he dreamed of doors that were open when they should have been shut, and shut when they should have been opened. During work the next day, the peculiar incident of the night before was at the back of his mind. When he came home that night, he opened the door carefully, wondering if it would be repeated. It wasn't. He hung up his coat and sat down in the armchair. Wearily, he filled his pipe and struck a match to it. As he dropped the stub of the match into the ashtray...
What's this? Cigarette stubs. Jane's brand. Freshly smoked. Mrs. Mooney! Mrs. Mooney!
You want me, sir?
I certainly do. Mrs. Mooney, who gave you permission to smoke my wife's cigarettes?
What's that, sir?
What right did you to smoke my wife's cigarettes?
But I didn't do anything of the sort, Mr. Patterson. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, right here in this ashtray are half a dozen of her... They're gone.
Gone?
Cigarette butts. They were in this ashtray a minute ago. Now they've disappeared.
Couldn't have been nothing in that tray, sir. I emptied all the ashtrays when I came in.
But I saw them. Or did I? What's the matter with me? Or is it me?
Was he losing his grip? In a grim sort of way, the thought made Jimmy feel almost cheerful. During the day, work was a godsend. Sometimes he was able to thrust aside for hours the fact that Jane was gone. Now, in the same way, he grappled with the question of his sanity. When Mrs. Mooney left for the evening, he went to the desk where Jane had kept her household accounts. He'd set the whole thing down on paper, examined it methodically, checking all the facts. He was about to do so when he noticed Jane's diary on top of the desk. For a moment, his mind stopped, his brain reeled.
Jane's diary, what's it doing here? I thought I'd locked it in the trunk. I know I put it in the trunk.
He sat there, staring at the diary. It couldn't be on the desk. He'd locked it in the trunk, but there it was. With trembling fingers, he thumbed through the pages until he reached the last entry.
September 26th. September 26th, today's date. But that's impossible. How could this have been written today? Jane's dead. And yet that's her handwriting.
Feeling like a sleepwalker in a nightmare, he began to read the entry. As he scanned the lines, it was as though Jane's voice was in the room.
This morning I went to the cemetery. It was very bad. 3 months since the accident. Time doesn't make it any easier to bear. Oh, Jimmy. Jimmy, I miss you so much.
Jane?
I'm developing a personal hatred for Chance. Chance, luck, whatever it is, it's not an abstraction anymore. It was Chance that killed Jimmy. It could have been me instead, or neither of us. Standing over Jimmy's grave today, I realized that. And it was almost more than I could stand.
She's alive. She wrote this. She thinks I'm the one that's dead.
Taking a pen, Jimmy began writing desperately under Jane's entry in the diary.
Jane, where are you? I'm not dead. I thought you were. In heaven's name, where are you?
After that, Jimmy's mind went blank. When he came to his senses again, he was sitting in an empty desk. No diary on it, and no pen between his fingers.
Where is it? That diary, where is it? Oh, I must have dreamed it. Fallen asleep in the chair and dreamed it. No. No, it was here. I can swear it was here. I wrote an entry underneath Jane's. Or did I? Am I imagining things? I've got to find out. There must be some way to get to the bottom of this.
The next morning, Jimmy bought a small camera with a flashbulb attachment. That night, when he came home from the office, he had the camera ready. He unlocked the door and opened it. Then, before he walked in, he put out his hand and struck wood. The door was still closed. He stepped back, quickly aimed the camera at the door, and snapped the shutter. The glare of the flashbulb blinded him for a moment. But when he was able to see again, the door was open.
That you, Mr. Patterson?
Yes, it's me.
I thought I heard something.
I was just taking a picture.
A picture?
Look, Mrs. Mooney, are you finished with your work?
I thought I'd just get the laundry together and take it out with me.
Let that go until tomorrow. Good night, Mrs. Mooney.
Jimmy waited impatiently until the cleaning woman was gone. Then he moved the film in the camera and put in a new flashbulb. Walking to the desk, he hardly dared to hope the diary would be there again, but there it was. Open, with a ruler across the pages to keep it so. He saw yesterday's entry and his own message. And beyond that was more writing in Jane's hand.
Jimmy, darling. When I opened the diary today, I found a message from you, as though you were alive. I know that can't be. It's all imaginary wish fulfillment, and I'm crazy to answer you, but please, darling, if I am sane and you are alive somewhere, tell me where you are.
With all his being, Jimmy wanted to write his reply, but he was afraid to spend the additional time. He aimed the camera at the diary and pressed the shutter button for the second time.
The diary. It disappeared again. Where did it go to? Where did it come from in the first place? What's happening here? Wherever that diary is, that's where Jane is. I've got to find her.
That's the story Jimmy told me. Now, I'm a lawyer, trained to take testimony. I mention the fact because I want it understood that I have not colored the story in any way. I've told it exactly as Jimmy told it to me, flatly and baldly, without any attempt to make it sound reasonable. As Jimmy said...
Well, that's it, Hal. That's exactly how it all happened.
But look here, it's impossible.
I don't blame you for feeling that way about it. I'd say the same thing. If I didn't have evidence to the contrary.
Evidence? You mean those photographs?
That's right.
Let me have a look at them.
Sure. And there's the first one, the shot of the door. Looks like a double exposure, doesn't it?
We got two doors here, nearly at right angles, both hung from the same door frame.
Here's the second shot. If you look close, you may be able to read Jane's handwriting on the page of the diary.
Yeah. Jimmy, darling, when I opened the diary today, I found a message from you, as though you were alive.
Well, Hal, do you still say it's impossible?
Yes.
But, Hal...
Jim, I'm your friend. You believe that, don't you?
Sure, I do, but you...
Now, there's a perfectly logical explanation for these incidents. Not a pleasant explanation, but the only one that makes any sense. Now, that door opening and closing, Jane's cigarettes in the ashtray, you saw all that because you wanted to see it. You made it up, not consciously, but out of your desperation. You had to believe that somehow, somewhere, Jane is still alive.
I do believe that, Hal.
But, man, can't you see you're kidding yourself?
If so, how do you explain the photograph of that door?
Trick photography. You covered half the film and exposed with the door closed. Then you exposed the other half of the film with the door open.
Maybe an expert photographer could do that, but I never even owned a camera until yesterday.
Look, you followed directions when you took those shots, didn't you?
Yes.
Well, then you must have been following directions when you took that trick shot of the door.
Okay, okay. But how do you explain the second photograph? The one with Jane's handwriting. Now, you were Jane's lawyer, you'd recognize her handwriting, wouldn't you?
I suppose so.
Look at that photograph. Isn't that Jane's handwriting?
Looks like hers, but it could be a forgery.
Forgery? But who would want to forge?
You would, Jim. That's right. Now, I had a client once, a girl. She accused a man of beating her up. She was absolutely sincere. She really believed it. But her own family admitted that she'd make the marks on herself. And the doctors agreed that she'd unconsciously blotted the memory of doing it out of her mind afterwards.
You think I forged all this unconsciously?
But what other possibility is there?
Remember the accident, Hal. Now, we came up behind that truck. When we skidded into it, the girder could have hit me, or Jane, or neither of us.
What does that prove?
It was pure chance that Jane was hit. It could have been me. If it had been me, Jane would be living in the apartment. She might very well have written that entry in the diary, isn't that so?
What's the point?
The point is this. There are a lot of possible futures. When today was in the future, there were a lot of possible todays. The present moment is only one of any number of presents that might have been. Now, that night before the girder came to our windshield, there were three possibilities. One in which I was hit, one in which neither one of us was hit, and one in which... Well, you do see what I'm getting at, Hal.
Are you really suggesting there's more than one present? That in some other present, Jane is alive and you're the one that's dead?
That's it, Hal. Some other dimension in time or space through which Jane and I had managed to communicate.
But how?
Well, it's beyond me, but there must be some scientific explanation.
Oh, Jim, you aren't serious.
Why not? Before the atomic bomb exploded, all reasonable people said atomic energy was preposterous. Every new discovery, every new step forward is preposterous. Until it happens.
I couldn't shake Jimmy's argument. After he left, I tried to decide on some course of action. Treat him as insane? But he was my friend. And besides, his delusion wasn't dangerous, not even to himself. I decided to wait for developments. One evening, about a week later, Jimmy and I had dinner together. He seemed to be in good spirits. He looked over the menu.
What are you going to order, Hal?
A steak.
Me too. Well, what's new, Counselor?
Well, I was about to ask you that. Have you had any more communication with Jane?
Oh, sure, we write each other notes every night. And by the way, I was right, Hal. Jane agrees there is more than one present. Now, in the present I exist in, Jane was killed. But in her present, I'm the one that's dead.
Oh, look, let's not get into that again.
Well, I don't mind talking about it. Now that I know Jane's alive, life is bearable. Matter of fact, there's only one drawback.
Only one drawback, huh? What's that?
Well, now that Jane and I have found each other, we'd like to get together. Someday, we hope to be able to bridge that gap.
Isn't that rather far-fetched?
Oh, no. Now, sometimes when Jane and I are writing notes to each other, both of us can feel the barrier between us wearing thin. Once it seemed to me that we actually touched hands, but I wasn't sure.
Jim. Oh, Jim.
What's the matter?
Oh, nothing. Go on with what you were saying. I let him go on, describing what he wrote to Jane and what she wrote to him, and how they both yearned for the time when the barrier between them would disappear and they'd be together again. That continued for several weeks. Then one night, as we were sitting in the park...
Hal, remember what I told you about the barrier wearing thin?
Sure, yeah.
Well, Jane and I were pretty close now. I'm almost certain I saw her in the living room last night.
Jimmy,
she disappeared before I could get to her. If I could only put my hands on her, if I could touch her just once.
Jim, you've got to stop this.
What?
Do something about these hallucinations.
Hold on, Hal.
Don't you see they're progressive? It started with seeing notes and cigarette butts, and now you're seeing people.
You're trying to tell me I'm losing my mind?
No, but I think you ought to have a talk with a psychiatrist. With the proper treatment, those hallucinations would disappear. But if you don't get help,
need any help. There's nothing wrong with me. My contacts with Jane are not hallucinations, and I can prove it.
How?
Look, Hal, didn't you have a near accident on the parkway last night? Didn't a car coming around a curve on the wrong side of the road almost smash head-on into you?
What? Yes, it did. I almost went into the ditch trying to get away from it. How did you know that?
Jane told me.
Jane?
She said that in her time channel, a crash killed Tony Shields.
You mean Tony Shields was the driver of that other car?
That's what Jane says.
But it's impossible!
There, Jane doesn't lie, Al. Why don't you check with Tony?
That you, Tony?
Yes.
This is Hal Haines. Look, Tony, there's a little thing that's been bothering me. I'd like to ask you about it. Were you driving your car on the parkway last night?
Yeah, I was.
You're sure it was last night?
Well, sure, I'm sure. Well, what's up, Hal?
Well, did you almost run into another car coming around that curve near Hawthorne?
Well, that's right. Oh, say, Hal, how'd you know that? Hal, are you still on the line? Did you hear me?
Yeah. Yeah, I heard you. I was the driver of the other car, Tony.
Well, I'll be hanged. Talk about a small world. Say, Hal, I owe you an apology. I was on the wrong side of the road. Must have scared you half to death.
Yeah. Yeah, you certainly did.
I'm sorry, Hal, but there's one thing I don't get. It was pretty dark last night. How'd you recognize me?
Well, I wasn't quite sure. That's why I phoned. I hung up, feeling dizzy. Jane had told the truth. But Jane was dead. But if she was dead, how could she know about Tony Shields and what happened on the parkway? It made no sense, no sense at all, unless Jane actually existed in some other level or dimension. But that was nonsense. Sheer nonsense. Still, I had to talk to Jimmy. I dialed his number.
phone rang a number of times. I was about to give up when...
Hello?
Jim, this is Hal. I got to talk to you.
Not now. I'm very busy.
But this is important. I just spoke to Tony.
Please, Hal, hang up.
All right. I'm coming over to your place.
No, you can't do that. I don't want you here now. Hal, Jane and I are very close. The barrier's getting thin. Paper thin. We've touched each other again.
When did this happen?
Just now, before you phoned. We're hoping and praying that the time barrier is about to break.
But it can't. What would happen if you turned up where she is or if she turned up here?
I don't know, but we'd be together, and that's all we care about.
Oh, but Jim, listen to me.
She's here.
What?
She's come through the barrier. Here in this room. I see her. Jane, is it really you?
Who else would it be? Hello, darling.
Jane.
Jimmy. Jimmy! He'd hung up on me. I dialed his number again. The phone rang and rang. No answer. I gave up and tried to figure it out. That woman's voice I heard over the phone, and I actually heard it. Was it Jane? Or was I becoming affected myself? I had to know. I went to Jimmy's apartment. I rang the bell. Kept ringing and ringing. No one answered. I tried to open the front door. It was locked. The back door was locked, too. The windows were shuttered. There was no way to get in. I tried to phone Jimmy the next morning. No answer. I called his office at noon. He hadn't been there. Finally, I went to the police and talked to Detective Thatcher. Thatcher and a couple of patrolmen went to the apartment. They forced the front door, got into the place, searched it, and found nothing. I was in the living room smoking a hopeless cigarette when Thatcher came to me.
All right, Mr. Haynes, let's have it.
Have what?
This is a joke, ain't it?
Certainly not.
Look, mister, you tell us you're worried about your friend. We come here and find every door and window locked from inside. Nobody here, nothing.
Well, what's a gag?
How did he get out of the apartment and still leave all the door and windows locked from the inside? He didn't disappear into thin air, did he?
What could I say? That Jimmy had escaped into the other now? That he was alive on some other level or dimension of existence is yet unknown to us? Thatcher would have taken me straight down to the psychiatric ward. I said nothing. The police dragged ponds and rivers for Jimmy's body, put out missing person bulletins and so forth. Eventually, it was recorded that Jimmy left town, and everybody accepted that obvious explanation. I'm the only one who knows what actually happened to Jimmy Patterson. So I'm setting this down for the record, to be placed in my safe deposit vault and open only after my death. You can't blame me. Would you care to spend the rest of your life in a straitjacket?
That's it. The Other Now by Murray Leinster. Thanks to Galaxy, that wonderful science fiction magazine now in the stand. And next week, another extraordinary tale of tomorrow out of Galaxy science fiction magazine called The Stars Are the Sticks by Theodore Sturgeon. A tingling drama sure to send your imagination spinning out beyond the moon to the man-made planet called Curbstone. The rendezvous of tomorrow's adventurers. This is your host, Omentor. And remember, we've got a date next week. Our time.
Tales of Tomorrow. Heard in tonight's play were Lawson Zerbe as Haynes, Dick York as Jimmy. Raymond Edward Johnson was your host. Music composed and conducted by Bobby Christian. Script adaptation by Michael Sklar. Produced by ABC in association with George Foley and directed by Clark Andrews.
Tales of Tomorrow, the radio version of that popular 1950s sci-fi series, episode 4 in the series, The Other Now, from January 22, 1953. That story originally appearing in Galaxy Science Fiction magazine. Two other 1950s sci-fi radio programs relied heavily on this publication for material, Dimension X and later X-1. If you're a fan of classic sci-fi television, do check out the television version of Tales of Tomorrow. Many episodes of that series are available on various video download sites, including YouTube, as that series is now in the public domain. Sadly, only a handful of the radio episodes survive today. It's the Upstate Radio Theater. I'm Jake Longwell. If you want to get in touch, it's qualityradioproductions@gmail.com. And the website, qualityradioproductions.blogspot.com. This is program number 1710. And we'll conclude the program with some classic comedy as we have an episode of The Jack Parr Show. In the late 40s, Jack Parr was an up-and-coming young comedian. This was his first big break, as in 1947, that other famous comedian named Jack Benny, suggested that Parr host his Summer Replacement series on NBC in 1947. This broadcast, program number 7 in the series, originally aired on July 13th of that year. Parr often parodied or spoofed popular culture on his show, and this episode, no exception. Children's Adventure Shows. It's the Jack Parr Show on the Upstate Radio Theater.
From Hollywood, Lucky Strike presents the Jack Parr Program with songs by Trudy Irwin, the Paige Cavanaugh Trio, Jerry Fielding in the orchestra, yours truly, Hi Aberback, and starring America's new young humorist, Jack Parr!
Thank you very much. Hello, and to those of you affected by the rent control bill, welcome to the great outdoors. Well, it's nice eviction weather we've been having, isn't it? Everyone's getting a notice to move. New York City just gave Brooklyn 24 hours to get out of town. Of course. Thank you very much. Of course, veterans are right in the middle of the housing trouble, the veterans. You see, thousands of them are living in chicken coops, but Congress has the solution. They've just appropriated $10 million to build new houses for the homeless chickens. Thomas E. Dewey is in the news this week, too. He's taking a trip across the country, which he says is non-political. He says he's not shaking hands with anyone or kissing babies. However, when he arrived in Oklahoma City, a set of twins fell out of his mustache. Yes, stay after the broadcast. We're working out together. Yes, the 1948 election is beginning to make news. There are so many men throwing their hats into the presidential ring that Mr. Truman would have enough to go back to his old line of business. It's a sneaker, I know. From England came news that Princess Elizabeth is going to marry Philip Mountbatten. I feel sorry for Phil. What good will it do him to wear the pants in their castle when his wife, of course, wears the crown? That was nothing. That's all right. Here we go. We're now on page 3. Never mind. It was nothing, really, just a week's work. That's all. I love you anyhow. Cesar Petrillo, head of the Musicians Union, is in the news this week, too. He might call a strike this winter, and I may lose the boys. If he does, Phil Spitalny is going to look silly waving a baton at 22 girls who are knitting. The The solo number would be handled by Evelyn and her magic pressure cooker. And now, friends, before anything drastic happens, here is the Paige Cavanaugh trio. Paige, Lloyd, and Benris. He's the one that keeps time. The boys are going to play with their hats on, just in case Petrillo makes a decision in the next 2 minutes. Fellas?
I wonder who's kissing her now. I wonder who's teaching her how. I wonder who's looking into her eyes. Breathing sighs, telling lies. I wonder who's buying the wine. For lips that I used to call mine. I wonder if she ever tells him of me. I wonder who's kissing her now.
Friends, all over the country, people still report seeing the flying discs. Of course, there are people who still haven't seen any of them. I guess they're waiting for the 1948 models to come out. I'm not saying these flying discs don't really exist, but nobody living in Kansas City has seen them, and that's a dry state. Actually, the way the human mind works, people see just what they want to see. For example, a member of the Van Johnson fan club reported seeing a disc with freckles. I doubt that personally, but now today, in order to bring you up to date on the disc situation, we have arranged to get some first-hand reports from people who have actually seen them. Good evening, sir. What is your name?
My name is Harold Crumbney. My friends call me Crumb.
Well, your friends know you better than I do, I guess. What do you do for a living, Harold?
I work as a mechanic in a sardine factory.
A mechanic in a sardine factory?
Yeah, every 1,000 sardines, I change the oil.
I see. Would you mind moving back a little? You're standing between me and the electric fan. Now then, Harold, can you give our radio audience a description of the disc you saw?
Well, certainly. The length was, I would say, between, well, anyway, the color was sort of, it was darker than that. It was more of a, well, then the width, it ran anyway from, no, it was even wider.
Harold, how did you get all these details?
Simple, I marked them down.
Oh.
You see, I'm used to this. I see a lot of junk.
You've seen other things besides discs?
What are you talking? I've seen all kinds of phenomenons. The other day, for instance, I seen a sea serpent.
Well, a lot of people have seen sea serpents.
In their bathtubs? I'm in a tub, see? I turns on a hot water faucet, and out comes a sea serpent.
Out of the hot water faucet? You must have been amazed.
I sure was. He usually comes out of the cold water faucet.
Well, thank you, Harold Crumbney. It's been grand having you. And let's not do it again real soon.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Hey, wait a minute. Ain't you going to give me a refrigerator?
I'm sorry we don't give away any refrigerators. This is an original type show, you know.
Well, then, how about a year's supply of something free? Anything.
We're not allowed to give away anything on this show.
Oh, yeah? How would you like a good punch in the nose?
I'm sorry, we're not allowed to accept anything either. Thank you and good night. And now, you saw one of the flying discs, madam?
Would I be here if I seen chopped liver?
I guess not. Would you mind telling us your name, please?
Clarice Shambles, Hillside 5413. If a man answers it's me, I got a sinus condition.
Now about these flying discs, Mrs. Shambles.
That's Miss.
Oh, I'm sorry.
How do you think I feel?
Now tell me, when did you witness this amazing sight?
Well, I'm sitting on the front porch last Saturday, about to shave my leg. I got them all lathered when... you see, all of a sudden, along comes a young man of the opposite sex. Hello, baby, he says to me, cool as you please. How would you like to go up on the roof and watch the flying disc? And so we go up to the roof.
What happened?
Nothing. The jerk shows me a flying disc.
Well, you haven't been of much help, but thanks anyway. Clarice Shambles, girl, nothing. And now you, sir, I understand you're a psychiatrist.
Yeah, that's correct. I am Dr. Heinrich Himmelstoss, known professionally as the Smiling Psychiatrist.
I'll remember that if I ever have a brain to trade in. Now, about these discs, Doctor.
Discs? Are you joking? I am a psychiatrist. This whole thing is a hallucination. I have studied the situation very carefully.
You've done some research?
Oh, yeah, yeah. First, I am looking through a telescope. Then I'm looking through a microscope. And then, for good measure, I am going to a burlesque.
And what were your conclusions?
The scientific explanation is mass hysteria induced by emotional insecurity leading to schizophrenic tendencies in the subconscious portion of the cerebellum. In other words, people is nuts.
Doctor, does that mean that people have too much dementia in their precox?
Precisely.
Well, there's just one thing I don't understand, Doctor. You say you spent time looking through a telescope, and yet you didn't see any discs.
Well, I'll tell you. I took my telescope up on the roof, and I looked around, and I did see something.
Then it might have been a disc.
I let you know. I got a date with her for next Tuesday night.
Well, friends, now that vacation time is here, visiting relatives are again in season. You've all had them. They usually drop in on you for the 4th of July weekend, and before you know it, they're helping you decorate your Christmas tree. All visiting relatives have one thing in common. They bring their children. You know what your relatives' children are? They're adults that come in a small, horrible size. As soon as they get to your house, they start right in, tear your rugs, wreck your furniture, break your dishes, set fire to your maid. And then their mother says, look at Junior, I wouldn't take anything in the world for him. She doesn't have to worry. She'll never get an offer. Yes, the visiting child is a public relative number one. Have you ever been left alone with one of them and tried to make conversation? What really goes on in your respective minds while you're being nice to each other? Shall we find out?
Thank you.
Well, well, little Walter, my favorite nephew. You've certainly grown into a fine broth of a boy.
Fine broth. Too bad he hasn't got all his noodles.
Thanks, Uncle Jack, and you're looking swell, too.
This must be my uncle that died last year.
My, you're such a bright little fellow. Your mother tells me you're the most advanced pupil in your class.
Sure, he's the most advanced. The other kids in the class are only 6, and he's 12.
Yes, Uncle Jack, I have been getting good marks, and that's because I've been going to school every single day.
I hope they don't find that trunk I buried with the truant officer in it.
Well, that's wonderful. And what are you going to be when you grow up?
Does he have to grow up?
Well, Daddy wants me to be a doctor, and Mommy says I should be a lawyer.
I'll meet him halfway and become a bookie.
Now, Walter, while you're here, I know you're going to have a good time. There's a little boy to play with up the street. Another little boy lives on the corner, and 2 little boys live right next door.
From a look in the kid's eye, I don't dare mention little girls.
That's super, Uncle Jack. I can't wait to meet those little boys.
This is murder, no dames.
Walter, I knew you'd turn out to be a sweet little boy. You had to be. You see, before you were born, your mother read the greatest literature, went to the opera, and listened only to the finest symphony music.
Spike Jones must have snuck in there somewhere.
Uncle Jack, you've been so keen to me, I wish I could do something to pay you back.
Maybe I ought to give him one of those chocolates with the Mickey Finn centers.
That's very nice. Now, you run upstairs and take a nap. I just wanted to have this little talk with you to make sure you and I are going to become real good friends.
That's right, Uncle Jack.
And now that we are good friends, aren't we, Walter?
Yes, Uncle Jack. Here, have one of my chocolates.
Now, here's our lovely young singing star, Trudy Irwin, the one-girl soloist, accompanied by Jerry Fielding and the All-Boy Orchestra.
I believe in wishing well. The daisy tell. I believe that a four-leaf clover brings lots of luck, lots of joy, lots of happiness. I believe those things. And when it's Christmas, I believe in Santa Claus. I believe that dreams come true. If you wish for the dream by a wishing well, don't tell the wish or you'll break the spell. It may sound naive, but that's what I believe.
friends, the other day I tuned in one of those kiddie programs for children, you know. In just 15 minutes, two people were shot, four poisoned, one thrown over a cliff, and two were strangled. Then the announcer said, "Good night, kiddies. Pleasant dreams." Another kiddie program I heard had a definite psychological twist. It was called Jack Armbuster, All-American Maniac. As a kid, Jack Armbuster started out hitting little girls. Then when he grew up and married, he would hit his wife. And he wasn't even faithful to her because he went around hitting other women, too. It's obvious that these days kids demand psychological motives in their stories. Does this mean that nursery rhymes and fairy tales will have to be rewritten? Is Mother Goose a dead duck? Take a simple nursery rhyme like Jack and Jill. How would it sound given a modern psychological treatment for the children of today? I can almost hear it now. The Strange Case of Jack and Jill.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Jack and Jill found at bottom of hill. Jill dead, lacerations on body, also crown broken. Police investigating. Read all about it. Extra, extra.
Lieutenant, I've told you over and over I had nothing to do with my wife's death. It was an accident. Please, Lieutenant, let me go home.
You mean you'd leave me alone in this nasty police station? Now, look, friend, we both know you killed your wife. Why don't you confess? Then I can go home to bed, and you can go to the electric chair.
But why would I kill my wife? Everybody knew us as the ideal couple, Jack and Jill.
Why does any man kill his wife? For freedom, jealousy, money, or because she goes around singing Chababa Chababa all the time?
Lieutenant, since you're accusing me of murder, I demand advice of counsel. I insist on calling my lawyer Humpty Dumpty Ginsburg.
Forget the mouthpiece, Joker. I know you killed your wife, and I know just how you did it. All I need to clinch this case is the motive.
I'll never tell you my motive.
Ah, stepped right into that one, didn't you?
No, it's just that I get confused so easily. After all, I'm a new murderer.
That does it, kid. How will you have it, AC or DC?
I didn't do it, I tell you. I didn't do it.
Ah, calm. Calm now. Tell me, sweetheart. Ever hear of a dame called Little Miss Muffet?
Who told you about it? Who told you about her?
Never mind. Allow me to read to you from a report I have here. May 19th. Jackson and company of Little Miss Muffet at Mother Goose's Bar and Grill. According to a witness, Jack spent afternoon of June 1st in home of Little Miss Muffet, sitting with her on her tuffet. Had enough?
Doesn't mean a thing, I tell you. You still can't prove I murdered Jill.
Kid, let me wise you up. Little Miss Muffet is dynamite. You think you were the only one in her life? Dozens of guys ruined their lives for Little Miss Muffet.
You mean there were others who sat on her tuffet?
Others? How do you think Simple Simon got so simple? He's still bouncing around the padded cell.
If I'd only known this, if I'd only known.
Well, you know it now, sucker.
And there's nothing left for me. All right, I'll talk. I'll tell you everything. I was happily married to Jill for 5 years. Then Little Miss Muffet moved into the house next door. What a woman she was. I was drawn to her helplessly. Love engulfed us. We were like two flies caught in molasses. And I was the fly with the worried expression. One night I sneaked out of the house and went to see Miss Muffet. We sat there for hours eating her curds and whey. What a cook that woman was. I told her I couldn't live without her. Then I went home. Jill was waiting up for me, her hair done up in curlers, cold cream on her face. She'd taken off her eyelashes for the night. As I turned on the light, she blinked her stumps at me and said,
Jack, where have you been? It's almost 3:00.
Why, darling, you know I always play poker with the boys Sunday night.
You don't know any boys and you can't play poker.
All right, then. I was out bowling with the girls.
Don't lie to me. You've been next door visiting that brazen Muffet hussy.
Well?
Jack, how can you do this to me? I've been a faithful wife. I've worked, I've slaved, I've kept house. And now you openly flaunt your love for this woman. You make me the laughingstock of the neighborhood. How can you do it? How can you? Don't Don't just stand there. Say something.
What else is new?
Jack, you don't really love Miss Muffet. Stop this madness before it's too late.
I can't, Jill. This is the end. You must let me go.
Let you go? I shan't, do you hear? I shan't! I shan't! I shan't!
She stood there, shanting at me. I knew then I was through with Jill. There was something in my mind that made me fickle with women. The year before, it had been Little Bo Peep. I thought I loved her, but I threw her over as soon as she lost her sheep. Now it was Miss Muffet, and Jill was in the way. I knew I had to kill her, but could I? After all, she was a human being and a woman. A rare combination. But I had to have Miss Muffet. I worked out a plan. The hill in back of the house, the well on top. If our plumbing was broken, we'd have to go up the hill to fetch a pail of water. I got a hammer and ran to the cellar. I had broken the plumbing. My plan for murder was working. I felt strong, alive, wet. Then I called to Jill. Sweetly, I said, Oh, Jill, darling, the plumbing's broken. Let's go up the hill to fetch a pail of water. She fell for it. We started up the hill. We got to the top. I pushed her. She fell for it again. You know the rest, Lieutenant. After I pushed her down the hill, I came tumbling after to cover up. Tell me. Tell me, will they send me to the chair?
All I can say, kid, if you own an Eversharp Lifetime pen, you got an awful big refund coming.
You've got to understand, Lieutenant, it's not my fault. It goes back to my childhood. We were poor, and when I married Joe, we were still poor. All she had was an old burlap tuffet. Then Little Miss Muffet came into my life. I couldn't resist her nylon tuffet.
Too bad. Now you got to pay.
Wait a minute. Give me a break, Lieutenant. You can't let them burn me.
All right, kid. If you haven't got the nerve, there's another way out. In back of this police station, there's a hill.
Yes?
Grab that bucket.
What are you going to do?
Kid, you and I are going up the hill to fetch a pail of water.
In our cast today were Lionel Stander, Florence Halep, Hans Conried, and Walter Tetley. Tune in next week to the Jack Parr Show with Trudy Irwin, the Paige Cavanaugh Trio, Jerry Fielding in the orchestra, yours truly, Hi Averback, and as our special guests, Robert Taft, Harold Stassen, Tom Dewey, General MacArthur, Henry Wallace, General Eisenhower, and Alf Landon.
Come early and pick your own candidate. Good night, everybody.
Don't forget, friends, for the Pops and Radio Entertainment, set your dial to NBC Wednesday night for that thrilling newspaper drama, The Big Story. And on Saturday night, don't miss Your Hit Parade with Martha Tilton, the Pied Pipers, and Your Hit Parade special guest, Dick Haynes.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
And with that episode of The Jack Parr Show, we've reached the end of this edition of the program. I'm Jake Longwell. Thank you, as always, for your company. Join me again soon for more great old-time radio. The Upstate Radio Theater is distributed by Quality Radio Productions.